Chapter 4. George Bernard Shaw et al. As an undergraduate in college, Pierce told me, I had a nagging worry about whether I was doing the right thing with my life. Did I really want to be a physicist, the route I was taking at that time? The question I asked myself was, how does a person decide what is the most important thing for him to do with his life? Should he be a teacher? A warrior? A doctor? A poet? A painter? Obviously, becoming some of these things is beyond your control. There is no point in trying to be a painter if you can't draw a straight line, or a poet if you can't express yourself in that medium. But this question did keep recurring, along with some corollary questions like, what set of standards do you use for judging what the right course is? What is important for a person to accomplish in his life? I knew I wanted to do something that was important. I had an awareness of my mortality from a very early age, and so it seemed to me that I shouldn't waste my life doing things that weren't truly important. I didn't want to be on my deathbed thinking, I've blown it. I had one life to live, and I didn't do what I should have done. While I didn't yet have a clear frame of reference, by the time I got to Oregon State as a professor of physics, in 1962, I had it in my head that I wanted to answer these questions and to direct my life based on the answers I came to. I started to do more general reading. Before, I had not had the time with all my science courses and activities. And gradually, things started to take shape in my head about what was important in life. It was a process of crystallizing the teachings I was taking from what I was reading and refining them and learning how to express them more coherently and finding ways to exemplify them. One of the things that helped me find direction was a play that I first came upon at Caltech back in 1955 or so. Man and Superman. Act 3 of the play was the one that really struck me. It expressed the idea that man shouldn't hold himself back. He should completely use himself up in service to the life force. I bought a set of phonograph records that just had that act in it. As I remember, it had Charles Lawton, Charles Boyer, Agnes Moorehead, and Cedric Hardwick. It was well done. Don Juan's expositions were what resonated with me. I listened to that set of records over and over and let it really sink in. The idea of an evolutionary universe hit me as being true, with an evolution toward higher and higher states of self-consciousness, and the philosopher's brain being the most highly developed tool for the cosmos coming to know itself. I felt I understood what Shaw meant. Over time, I have elaborated upon this idea. I came to call it cosmotheism, and discussed it in a series of talks I gave in the 1970s. I obtained a copy of Man and Superman, the play Pierce referred to, and read it. It was first performed in 1905 in London and has been a theater staple ever since. Coincidentally, a successful run of the play was about to end in Washington at the time I talked to Pierce about it, and I was able to drive over from West Virginia to catch a performance before the play closed. Man and Superman was written by the renowned conversationalist, critic, satirist, pundit, and playwright, George Bernard Shaw. Shaw was born in 1856 in Dublin and died in 1950. Man and Superman is a long play, about 3.5 hours. Often, Act 3 is performed as a separate piece and called Don Juan in Hell, and this is what Pierce listened to on the record. After reading and seeing the play, it became clear what it was about this particular play that so captured Pierce's imagination at that time in his life. The central question the play explores is the very one that Pierce himself was confronting. what is the most important thing to do with one's life? And not only was the question relevant to Pierce's life at that point, the answer Shaw gives to that question through this play had great appeal to Pierce, and that was to give your all to being a force of nature, so to speak. In prefatory remarks to the published version of the play, Shaw wrote, quote, "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being thoroughly worn out before you are thrown on the scrap heap, the being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. And also, the only real tragedy in life is being used by personally minded men for purposes you recognize to be base." End quote. The idea of being worn out in the service of a mighty purpose was exactly what this bright young graduate student in California had been looking for. In Act 3 of Man and Superman, its central characters have traveled from their homes in London to vacation in an untamed mountainous area of Spain. Among them is Jack Tanner, modeled after a young Shaw, his potential love interest, Anne Whitefield, and Anne's guardian, Roebuck Ramsden. Immediately upon arriving in Spain, the party is pounced upon by a group of bandits whose chief is a man named Mendoza. Mendoza, it so happens, is a Jew. As Mendoza puts it, the role of the gang he leads is to, quote, "hold up motor cars and secure a more equitable distribution of wealth," end quote. Mendoza informs Jack and the others that the band of brigands aims to extract a tidy ransom before allowing them to go on their way. Jack tells Mendoza that he is amenable to that idea, but it is mutually decided that since it is late in the evening, the transmission of funds would best wait until the morning. So they all bed down for the night. They fall off to sleep, and Jack has a dream. Almost all of the rest of the act, or play when it is performed separately, is Jack's dream. The setting of Jack's dream is hell, and everybody in the dream is a character we have met before in the play, but transformed into someone else. Jack is the 15th century nobleman Don Juan. Anne becomes Doña Ana de Ulloa. Ana for short. Roebuck is a talking statue. And Mendoza is the devil. This dream state setting and cast of characters sets up what is essentially a debate between Don Juan and the devil about what life ought to be about and which is a better place to be, Don Juan's version of heaven or the devil's version of hell. When the antagonists talk about heaven and hell, it is clear that they aren't referring to places or states up there or down there in an afterlife. They are both using heaven and hell as metaphors for ways of being in this life. Don Juan sets out his case early in the act. Hell is the situation here on Earth right now. It is the way most people live, and he wants out. "In heaven, as I picture it," he declares, "you live and work instead of playing and pretending. You face things as they are. You escape nothing but glamour, and your steadfastness and your peril are your glory." What will Don Juan do once he gets to heaven? He will think. I hope to escape at last from the lies and from the tedious, vulgar pursuit of happiness, to spend my eons in contemplation. And it is not just any kind of contemplation that will occupy Don Juan's time in heaven. It is contemplation of life, with a capital L, or, as it comes to be called as the act proceeds, the life force. Don Juan declares to Mendoza, Even as you enjoy the contemplation of such romantic mirages as beauty and pleasure, so would I enjoy the contemplation of that which interests me above all things, namely, life. The force that ever strives to attain greater power of contemplating itself. And just what is this life which is being referred to? As Don Juan speaks of it, life is an entity unto itself, a separate being of sorts. According to Don Juan, life, or the life force, this entity, this being, has monumentally important purposes. To become aware of itself and understand itself, and to realize itself. That is to say, become the finest version of what it truly is. He refers to life's, quote, continual effort not only to maintain itself, but to achieve higher and higher organization and completer self-consciousness, end quote. Don Juan refers to the full achievement of these ends as the attainment of, quote, Godhead, end quote. As Don Juan sees it, in all likelihood, Godhead won't come without a mighty struggle. Life faces extremely formidable enemies. The forces of death and degeneration. Life's central impulse is to move toward the creation of a superior kind of human being, Don Juan asserts. That is what life, at its core, is about. Here, Don Juan is expressing an evolutionary Darwinian idea, the concept of man evolving into something higher, more advanced than he is now. Life, as Don Juan perceives it, is the force that seeks to bring about, quote, higher and higher individuals, the ideal individual being omnipotent, omniscient, infallible, and with all completely, unalludedly self-conscious. In short, a god. End quote. Don Juan brings race into it as he affirms the, quote, great central purpose of breeding the race, breeding it to heights now deemed superhuman. That purpose, which is now hidden in a mephistic cloud of love and romance and prudery and fastidiousness, will break through into clear sunlight. End quote. But if the life force is going to accomplish its great mission, prevail in its epic struggle, it is going to need some help, says Don Juan. Namely, it needs brains to give it direction. Quote, it needs a brain, this irresistible force, lest in its ignorance it should resist itself. End quote. And later on in the act, he states, quote, to life, the force behind the man, intellect is a necessity, because without it, he... the life force, man, both... blunders into death, end quote. And where is the life force going to get the brains it needs? From contemplative, philosophical people like Don Juan. That is why he is leaving hell and going to heaven in the first place, to establish better contact with the life force and figure out exactly what it needs in order to become self-conscious and self-realized. And more than just provide the needed philosopher's brain, Don Juan also aims to provide the life force with some brawn to help it stay on course and move forward. Don Juan intends to take action to help the life force along in its journey. Thus, Don Juan lauds a certain kind of philosopher, one who, quote, seeks in contemplation to discover the inner will of the world, in invention to discover the means of fulfilling that will, and in action to do that will by the so-discovered means, end quote. He holds up the ideal of an individual who can see beyond the physical world to the true purpose of life, so that he can work for that purpose rather than, quote, thwarting it and baffling it by setting up short-sighted personal aims as at present, end quote. And what is going to keep us from pursuing this ideal? According to Don Juan, it is our own lack of courage and preoccupation with respectability. Quote, "Man gives every reason for his conduct save one, and that is his cowardice." End quote. He asserts, quote, "All civilization is founded on his cowardice, on his abject tameness, which he calls his respectability." End quote. There is a way to overcome these personal limitations, however, and that is to find an idea worth giving one's life to. Quote, "Men never really overcome fear until they imagine they are fighting to further a universal purpose, fighting for an idea," end quote. Don Juan declares. That is why the idea of serving the life force is such a powerful one in his eyes. It enables people to live the life they would lead if they weren't so afraid and caught up in what others might think of them. The devil responds to Don Juan's assertions by declaring that nature, his term for the life force, in fact has no purpose. "You're wrong," counters Don Juan. The philosopher's brain is nature's pilot, helping it to get to its destination. It is the success with which you have directed the attention of men from their real purpose, Don Juan accuses the devil, which is in one degree or another the same as mine, to yours, that has earned you the name of the tempter. It is the fact that they are doing your will, or rather drifting with your want of a will, instead of doing their own, that makes them the uncomfortable, false, restless, artificial, petulant, and wretched creatures they are. In place of that negative circumstance, Don Juan is offering what he says is a positive alternative. An individual with a purpose in life that goes beyond his own individual needs and wants. Don Juan is holding up the image of someone who devotes his life to serving the life force. This is a person who supports the life force in knowing itself and reaching its destination. Don Juan is saying this is how one should live. Don Juan's ideal existence sounds a bit staid and drab to Anna, who has been listening to the exchange between the two men. She asks, "Is there nothing in heaven but contemplation, Juan?" To which Don Juan replies, "In heaven, I seek no other joy. There is the work of helping life in its struggle upward. Think of how it wastes and scatters itself, how it raises up obstacles to itself and destroys itself in its ignorance and blindness. As long as I can conceive of something better than myself, I cannot be easy until I am striving to bring it into existence or clearing the way for it. That is the law of my life. That is the working within me of life's incessant aspiration to higher organization, wider, deeper, intenser self-consciousness, and clearer self-understanding. It was the supremacy of this purpose that reduced love for me to the mere pleasure of a moment, art for me to the mere schooling of my faculties, religion for me to the mere excuse for laziness, since it had set up a god who looked at the world and said it was good, against the instinct in me that looked through my eyes at the world and saw it could be improved. I tell you that in pursuit of my own pleasure, my own health, my own fortune, I have never known happiness. It was not love for woman that delivered me into her hands. It was fatigue, exhaustion." This last sentence in Don Juan's speech reveals a hint of the notion that women tend to get in the way of what a man has to do in life. It is an example of the coolness toward women that shows up several places in this act of Shaw's play. Other examples. At one point, Don Juan says, "I turned my back on the romantic man with the artist nature. I told him that his beauty worshipping and happiness hunting and woman idealizing was not worth a dump as a philosophy of life." Another example, Don Juan talks about how romantic men had led him, quote, into the worship of woman, end quote. In another context, he goes on about how we, presumably referring to men, are, quote, deluded and mind-bended towards honorable love as the highest good. And to understand by honorable love, romance and beauty and happiness in the possessions of beautiful, refined, delicate, affectionate women, end quote. At one point, Anna says to Don Juan, I'm going with you. To which Don Juan replies, I can find my own way to heaven, Anna, not yours. I prefer to be my own master and not the tool of any blundering universal force, the devil informs Don Juan. I know that beauty is good to look at, that music is good to hear, that love is good to feel, and that they are all good to think about and talk about. As for your life force, in the end, serving it will lead you to despair and decrepitude, broken nerve and shattered hopes, vain regrets for the worst and silliest of wastes and sacrifices, the waste and sacrifice of the power of enjoyment. In a word, the punishment of the fool who pursues the better before he has secured the good. But at least I won't be bored, Don Juan replies. So fare you well, Señor Satan. Don Juan then asks the statue to direct him to heaven. The statue replies that the frontier between heaven and hell is only the difference between two ways of looking at things. Quote, any road will take you across if you really want to get there. End quote. And off goes Don Juan. As he fades from view, the devil warns Anna, beware of the pursuit of the superhuman. It leads to an indiscriminate contempt for the human. Tell me, Anna asks the devil, where can I find the Superman? He is not yet created, the devil answers. Not yet created, Anna cries. Then my work is not yet done. I believe in the life to come. A father for the Superman. Anna looks at where Don Juan had been standing, but by then he was gone. It is remarkable how this play by Shaw that Pierce first read over 40 years ago has so many of the elements that have become parts of Pierce's own life. Among them, the disdain for the shallowness and misguidedness of contemporary life, the idea of seeking a grand purpose to direct one's life, the value in facing reality head-on rather than living a life of, quote, playing and pretending, end quote. The vital importance of the intellect and of acquiring a comprehensive perspective on things. The idea of serving the life force as the organizing principle and purpose of one's life. The focus on improving the race. The view of life as a struggle against powerful opposing forces. The anti-Jewish theme. Again, in the Shaw play, the devil is a Jew. The importance of courage and the willingness to transcend one's desire for respectability. The virtue and steadfastness of holding firm and staying the course. The perception of a contradiction between love, family, and women on the one hand, and men achieving their purpose in life on the other. It is too simple to say that there is a direct and exclusive causal line between this play and what Pierce has done with his life. Indeed, many factors account for what he has become. But Pierce does single out listening to the Shaw play as a major turning point in his life. And after looking into the play, I believe him. The Shaw idea, Pierce told me, and the elaborations I had made on it, had answered this fundamental question of what was the most important thing that one can do with one's life. The proper purpose in life. In a general sense, anyway, I'd answered it. And that is to serve the life force. Do whatever you can to make a more conscious, beautiful, highly evolved universe. But that still left the specific question of how does somebody go about doing that? Of course, that question has different answers for different people. You can go about it in different ways. You could be a physicist and learn more about how the universe works. That's one way, and that is the course I had been on. When I was in graduate school, I decided I wanted an academic career in physics, even though the salaries in industry at that time were about twice what they were in the university. But buying a lot of goodies didn't appeal to me as much as having the freedom to set my own schedule and work at my own pace and do what I wanted to do, and not some project somebody gave me. Back then, it is still true, in universities of the first and second rank, physics faculty had responsibility for 3 classes, 9 hours a week. That would give me time to study and think. Plus, the university environment appealed to me, the ivy-covered buildings and all. So I wanted to be an academic physicist, and that stayed true my first 2 years at Oregon State University. But you didn't stay in physics. Why not? Up to that point in my life, I never gave any time to thinking about race or political concerns. I had been just into physics, and until I was married, chasing girls and my hobbies. I had bought an airplane and went scuba diving and sailing. But this was during the 1960s, remember, and I became increasingly aware of what I saw as very serious social problems. There was the Civil Rights Revolution and the protests against the war in Vietnam. All this hell-raising. Society was beginning to unravel, and so I had to think about how that fit in with the fundamental issue I was confronting. I think it was just a matter of timing. If I had gone to Oregon State in 1955, when things were much more normal and stable, rather than in 1962 when I did, I probably would have stayed and become a full professor. If I had come earlier, I would have had graduate students working for me, and I would have had more connections on campus and been older and less adventurous. Maybe I would have deplored what was going on and would have talked it over with other people, but I would probably have stayed on the faculty. There were 2 major social developments that were beginning to be very noticeable in this country, and to me, as the 60s wore on. One of them was the campaign against the war in Vietnam, and the other was the Civil Rights Revolution. What really got my attention about the anti-war activity was the particular way in which it was being carried out. People were actually demonstrating in favor of the communists. They were very open about their sympathy for the Viet Cong. I couldn't help but contrast that kind of thing with the situation in the Second World War. If anybody had begun waving swastika flags and shouting, "Ho, ho, Hitler's going to win," or something like that, a ton of bricks would have fallen on them. Ways would have been found to lock them up, you can be sure of that. Dissent was a big no-no back then. I thought about why, during the Second World War, in contrast to what was going on in the 60s, the government and media were so much more resolute about having everybody in sync, marching in lockstep. I'm old enough to remember all the little things that were done during World War II to get people in a war frame of mind. For example, they had all sorts of drives and collections for things, as if we had great shortages of these materials, and that made a big difference. They'd collect aluminum pots and pans and say they were going to make bombers out of them. I'm not sure they actually did that, but that wasn't what it was all about anyway. It was to get the civilians involved and stifle dissent. I was a kid, 8 or 9 years old, during the war, and I used to take my wagon and go from house to house and collect kitchen grease. I tell people I was collecting it for the war effort. I suppose they did convert the grease into high explosives, but again, these drives were to get people involved and in the mood for the war. The government didn't want to give people the chance to think any other way. By the way, what I'd actually do with the stuff I collected was sell it at the grocery store for 8 or 10 cents a pound. I made good money doing that. Another example of what I'm talking about is they had people in Norfolk, Virginia, where I lived, digging air raid shelters. There was a big naval base there, so it was a strategic center. But really, there was no chance there was going to be an air raid in Norfolk. Where was it going to be launched from? The enemy had no bases anywhere close enough to get that done. But they had people digging shelters and acting as air raid wardens. They even had people paint the top half of their car headlights black so the lights wouldn't shine so much. Just busy work to get people in the right mood and keep them from dissenting regardless of what their private thoughts were. But in the Vietnam War, where we were fighting against little yellow people, instead of our own kindred, as we were in World War II, against the Germans, we had none of this boost-the-war sort of activity. And we had people demonstrating on behalf of the enemy, waving Viet Cong flags and burning American flags. It took me a while to start putting the pieces together and see, for example, how prominent Jews were in these anti-war activities, and how they were using the war as a tool for social change, social upheaval. Fairly quickly, I saw that something serious was going on, and it got me thinking and reading about other wars we had fought, and what our motivation was then, and the significance of what was going on now. Why this big sympathy for communism and so on. As for the Civil Rights Revolution, of course, there had been people working on that for a long time. But in the 60s, it really made the headlines and got on television with the kind of theater and speechifying that was going on. The sit-ins at lunch counters and marches and all. There were a lot of things happening on the campus in connection with this, and it caused me to stop and think. As I said before, if things had been more or less normal during these years, and the problems had been the usual social vices like alcoholism, smoking, and so on, I probably would have thought and talked about it some, but I wouldn't have seen any need to get involved in a crusade or change my life over it. But I saw the anti-war and civil rights movements as being fundamentally more important than these other things, and that they were taking us somewhere. The events themselves may have been transitory, but they were part of an accelerating change in our society. I was interested in where we were headed and whether we really wanted to go there and whether I wanted society to go there. Other faculty on my campus were getting involved in these issues, but at that point I hadn't taken sides. I was still mainly interested in physics, playing with my electronic toys and teaching my courses. I was just trying to figure out what it all meant. But as I got a clearer picture of what it did all mean, I found it more and more disturbing. I came to see the anti-war movement and the failure of the government to fully support the military effort in Vietnam as literally killing our people. Young Americans were dying in Southeast Asia at a substantial rate. War is a serious matter, and if it is going to be the government's policy, they ought to go at it full bore and make sure the mission is accomplished as soon as possible so as to minimize casualties. The crap that was going on during those years, the pro-Viet Cong demonstrations and so on, and it was mostly Jews who were organizing these things, ought not to be tolerated. It was clear to me that the government wasn't going at this war in Vietnam full bore. The people in Washington setting the war policy were more concerned about what the Washington Post was going to say about it than whether it was a good military strategy. And really, that was understandable, because back in World War II, the government didn't have to worry about public opinion, because all the major propaganda instruments, the motion picture industry, the big newspapers, and so on. Controlled by Jews, it so happened. Liked that war a lot. And were 100% cooperative. Things were different now because the big media outlets weren't enamored of the Vietnam War, and the government had to take that into account so as not to run up against them. And I could see where the civil rights movement was headed. They were aiming at the complete social integration of blacks into white society. There had been the Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court in 1954, integrating the schools. And Eisenhower had sent the troops to Little Rock in 1958 to enforce integration at Central High School there. I was a graduate student then and didn't pay all that much attention to what was going on. But now at Oregon State, I did. This was going to result in black culture having a much bigger effect on white culture than it had had. And it was going to lead to greater numbers of interracial marriages and racially mixed children. I saw that coming. We already had jazz. I know a lot of whites are fanatics about it, but personally, I could never see what the hell the attraction was. But it wouldn't just be the defensible things like jazz that we were going to get. We were also going to get black attitudes toward work and sex and education and authority and personal restraint. And we were going to get the rest of their music, and all that was going to degrade white culture, not enrich it. That was coming along if the civil rights revolution had its way. And at about this time, I took my first hard look at interracial marriage, Pierce said. Pierce then told me about another physics professor with whom he socialized. This professor had married a mulatto woman, as Pierce described her, and they had had several children. Pierce said their situation raised questions for him and evoked what he called an instinctive response. Why did his friend choose to marry this woman? Pierce asked himself. How could he feel a kinship with her? Pierce was repelled by the, quote, awful-looking, end quote, appearance of the children, whom he described as, quote, flat-faced and dusky-colored, end quote. Pierce said he knew this father loved these children, but he just couldn't understand how his colleague could identify with them. This must have been a very powerful, formative experience for Pierce, because he brought it up several times during my talks with him. I think his reaction to this interracial couple and their children, whom he knew quite well, and the jumble of thoughts and feelings it evoked in him, was a major turning point in his life. He respected his fellow scientist, was friends with him, saw the love in this family, and at the same time, found himself churning over it and thinking that something was off about it, unnatural. It prompted him to raise questions, the answers to which would shape the course of his life. I knew enough about history, Pierce continued, to realize that you really have to keep your finger in the dike, or it is going to get out of control. The average white guy who only thinks about what is going to happen 30 minutes from now doesn't see that. He sees blacks demonstrating for civil rights, and he doesn't look at it as any real threat to him. And besides, he probably buys into the idea being sold him that what is going on is all about freedom and social justice and not about culture and racial survival. He doesn't worry about what this is going to mean for his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. But if he were to look at this from an historical and racial perspective, he'd see that if he allows this to happen, in a few generations up the road, it is going to mean the end of white America. We are going to end up another Brazil, a mixed-race nation. I realize that I have a turn of mind that leads me to exaggerate and oversimplify things for the sake of better understanding, and I know there are dangers in that. But I think that tendency in me helps me get to the essence of things. I do believe it helped me get at the core of what was going on with these two social movements, civil rights and anti-Vietnam War, when, for the first time in my life, I had the opportunity and the desire to pay close attention to what was going on around me. What came out of it for me was the realization that I had to do something about the conclusions I was coming to. And that posed some real challenges to me. I liked physics and didn't want to give it up. Being in a university is a relatively easy life. There's status and long vacations. And the money is pretty good, actually. I had a young family to support. 2 sons. And my wife wasn't working, and she was completely dependent on me. But I couldn't stay quiet about this. All through this time, I was doing a lot of reading, Pierce told me. And that helped me form my interpretation of the world around me. I thought that only after I interpreted the world around me could I answer the question of specifically what I should do with my life. I have always been an eclectic reader, so I would wander through the shelves of a library and spot a book that struck my fancy and take it home and read it. Among the books Pierce read, he told me, were those by the German philosopher of history, Oswald Spengler, including Decline of the West, Hour of Decision, and Men and Technics. Pierce said he also had read some of Spengler's aphorisms. Spengler was born in 1880 and died in 1936. He is best known for Decline of the West, published in 2 volumes in 1918 and 1922. Decline of the West contains a pessimistic thesis that Western civilization is in a period of decline and that its rejuvenation is impossible. Pierce came away from reading Spengler with the idea that Western civilization is under threat and that its continuance is problematic, that there are no guarantees that our way of life will persist and that we had better be vigilant to what is happening to it. I also read Brooks Adams at Oregon State, Pierce told me. He wasn't as much of an influence in an ethical and epistemological sense as Shaw was, but in terms of understanding history and different types of people, I thought he had a lot of insight. Brooks Adams was a late 19th century economist and historian. He was a member of the distinguished Adams family. His great-grandfather was John Adams, one of the founders and the second president. His grandfather was the 6th president, John Quincy Adams. And his brother was the famed Harvard historian Henry Adams. The Brooks Adams book that influenced Pierce was his 1903 tome, The Law of Civilization and Decay. In particular, there was one point from the book that stuck with Pierce. The distinction Adams draws between 2 basic types of individuals. Adams referred to one type as spiritual men, and to the other as economic men. Adams describes spiritual men as adventurous and idealistic. They are men of vision and daring. They have a strong connection to their roots, to their heritage. Spiritual men are builders of civilization, says Adams. As examples of spiritual men, he lists farmers, warriors, and poets. Adams sees the English yeomanry, farmer/warriors in olden days, as epitomizing spiritual men. Adams says that economic men come to the fore after a civilization is built. While the spirit of adventure and the current of idealism run strong in spiritual men, economic men are materialists. They are typified by the merchant and the bureaucrat. Pierce draws on Adams' categorizations to characterize economic men as the ones who know how to calculate the odds and evaluate an opportunity. They have cut themselves loose from their spiritual roots and become cosmopolitans to the extent that that offers them a personal and economic advantage. Pierce cites contemporary lawyers, businessmen, and politicians as examples of economic men. Since those early days at Oregon State, Pierce has been concerned by what he sees as the loss among European men of their spiritual and aesthetic sense, their warrior spirit, and their feeling for what is divine. Pierce often uses the word cosmopolitan and cosmopolitanism to describe what has become of European Americans, and obviously he doesn't like it. In one of our talks, I asked him to define the term cosmopolitan. Basically, cosmopolitan, at least as I use it, he replied, is a synonym for multicultural. I date the word cosmopolitan back to the 1930s when the magazine by that name was launched. Or at least I think it was in the 30s. Anyway, in that context, cosmopolitan was used to refer to someone who was urbane, sophisticated, familiar with many things, not narrow and parochial at all. In that day, it didn't have the connotation I and others bring to it now, which is someone who is deracinated, devoid of race, and rootless. When I use it, I think of whites in some place like New York City or Washington, D.C. So, when you talk about cosmopolitan, you're not so much getting at the idea of someone who is with it, which is the way I think of it. No, for me, cosmopolitan has a different meaning from that. To me, it means no longer really white, no longer really Western. It is a blended sort of person. I guess that is how to put it. Also around this time, Pierce told me, I read Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Friedrich Nietzsche, and that had a big impact on me. Nietzsche, born in 1844, died in 1900, was a German philosopher and classical scholar. He was a professor of classics at the University of Basel in Switzerland from 1868 to 1878 when he retired due to poor health. Nietzsche devoted himself to writing from that point until 1889, when he suffered a mental breakdown from which he never recovered. He wrote a number of books, among them, The Birth of Tragedy, Beyond Good and Evil, and The Genealogy of Morals. The book Pierce read, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, was written from 1883 to 1885 and published in four parts, the last being in 1892. It alternates between poetry, parodies, epigrams, and pronouncements by the prophet Zarathustra to his admirers. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is widely considered to be Nietzsche's greatest work. Nietzsche is ranked among the most influential and widely studied and debated philosophers in the history of that field. He has had a great influence on many philosophers, artists, psychologists, and social analysts, and remains widely discussed to this day. Three ideas that Nietzsche formulated bear mention in this context. The will to power, the concept of the overman or superman, and the contrast between what Nietzsche called a slave morality and a master morality. By will to power, Nietzsche meant the urge to dominate or master. He saw this urge as being a primary force in all life, including in man. The will to power, according to Nietzsche, explains the human tendency to press forward, often in the face of great strain, tension, and pain, and even the prospect of death, to accomplish tasks that allow one to feel powerful, capable, and strong. Some have misinterpreted Nietzsche as equating the will to power with domination and mastery over other people. Much more, Nietzsche was talking about power over one's self. He wasn't really interested in political or economic power. What he most cared about was self-mastery and self-overcoming, becoming better than one is now. Nietzsche saw the will to power as the force that gives a unique value to human life. He thought that mankind could use this force consciously, to become the embodiment of the vision of a higher form of man that he articulated. He imagined human beings mastering their own energies and channeling them so as to serve the process of transforming themselves into beings of boundless passion, fierce joy, and creative might. These creatures would be the overmen, or supermen. They would embody our glorious destiny. There is one obstacle in the way of achieving the Superman that Nietzsche perceived, and it takes the form of a set of moral values. That is to say, concepts of right and wrong. Nietzsche called that set of moral values that stood in the way of the development of the Superman the slave morality. He contended that the slave morality is the product of the fear and resentment of the strong and accomplished among the weak and less able. He accused the Christian church of articulating and legitimizing the resentment of the common people against the masterful people in order to gain power for itself. The church encourages lesser people to define their own weakness as good, and the aggressive strength and mastery of their betters as bad, said Nietzsche. According to the slave morality, pride and ferocity are bad, and meekness and humility are good. And tough-mindedness is bad, and sentimentality is good. The slave morality condemns self-assertion as arrogance, perverts the body and sexuality with shame, and undercuts earthly life by extolling an illusionary afterlife. Nietzsche saw the slave morality as essentially a denial of life. Nietzsche called for a master morality which will affirm life pursued with zeal, promote self-transcendence, and eliminate a preoccupation with guilt. Nietzsche implored man to remain faithful to this earth. Instead of constructing an ideal above the clouds that only underscores human inferiority, he wanted us to conceive of a higher type of humanity and exert ourselves to realize it. In order to embark on that adventure, he contended, we have to expunge the morality that keeps us enslaved. The Superman and the means of creating this being must become the standard of value, said Nietzsche. What was it about Nietzsche that hit home with you? I asked Pierce. In the prologue of Zarathustra, there are some lines that stuck in my mind. Let me see if I can find them. Pierce reached behind him, immediately found his paperback copy of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, flipped pages for about 3 seconds, and began reading passages. Quote, behold, I teach you the Superman. The Superman is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say, the Superman shall be the meaning of the earth. Man is a rope fastened between animal and Superman, a rope over an abyss. A dangerous going across, a dangerous wayfaring, a dangerous looking back, a dangerous shuddering and staying still. What is great in man is that he is a bridge and not a goal. What can be loved in man is that he is a going across. I love all those who are like heavy drops falling singly from the dark cloud that hangs over mankind. They prophesy the coming of the lightning, and as prophets they perish. Behold, I am a prophet of the lightning and a heavy drop from the cloud. But this lightning is called Superman. End quote. The Superman. What does that concept mean to you? I asked Pierce. Nietzsche spent a lot of time in his writings, and especially in Zarathustra, lamenting human frailties and foolishness and looking forward to the time when we will overcome these things. To Nietzsche, the Superman embodies the ideal outcome of this process of overcoming. The Superman represents what man can become at his best. The Superman does not exist as yet. He is not yet born. But he will be born out of mankind. He isn't some kind of separate or transcendent being. So it comes down to an evolutionary job, a breeding job, which is to be completed over, probably a great period of time. The task of those alive now is to prepare the earth for the Superman. Pave the way, serve this process. Do you see what I am saying? I think so. I have read a fair amount of Nietzsche's writings. Do you have a picture of the Superman in your mind? To some extent. I think we can get some hints or partial ideas of what the Superman is like by looking at the range of qualities we see in ourselves and other people today and in people in the past, and then putting those qualities on a scale of low to high based on Nietzschean values, and then extrapolating to the very highest ideal. I think that gets us heading in the right direction. What kinds of qualities are at the top of the scale as you see it? Wisdom is one. Wisdom grounded in objectivity, the ability to see the world as it really is. And there's courage, not being fearful or cowardly. Self-mastery is one. In fact, this is probably the most valuable trait a person can have. And willpower, the ability to use fully all of the talents and strengths that you have and not succumbing to weaknesses and being able to stick to a task once you've made the decision to do something, putting everything else aside and focusing your ability and energy on accomplishing that task. Those are some that I put at the top of the list. I have a cartoon somewhere I clipped out of a New Yorker magazine that every writer ought to have hanging on the wall. It is a guy sitting at his typewriter trying to write, and there is this little demon on his shoulder, and the demon is saying, "Hey, let's go down to O'Malley's and have a brew." The guy is obviously tormented because that is exactly what he wants to do, but at the same time, he is trying to force himself to stay at his typewriter and write. A great weakness of mine I have tried to overcome is procrastination, goofing off and doing easy things rather than addressing the really hard things. Willpower, the ability to use oneself fully, is so important. And I think it is a quality that can be maximized with proper child raising and educational approaches. We can greatly improve in this area over what ends up being the case with people today. That is why I think permissiveness is such a destructive way of raising kids. The only way a child learns self-control that he can exercise as an adult is if external discipline is applied to him when he is young. It is only when a child is given a task to do, and he knows that he must do it, or there will be hell to pay, can he develop the strengths that will support him in overcoming hardship and adversity and getting really big jobs done in later life. The philosophy today so often is that children shouldn't be pushed to do things they don't want to do, and that they should never have to experience failure or the consequences of failure, and that there should always be a way out. I think it is disastrous to teach kids that there are no real consequences, that nothing bad is really going to happen to you if you goof off when you have been told to do something. It just trains people to behave that way. My parents were probably a little better than average in their attitudes toward child raising. I look and I see some areas where I am strong because of how they brought me up, but I can also see some of my weaknesses, and I think of how much better it would be for me today, how much more I would be able to accomplish if I had had a much more rigorous upbringing than I had. And this, of course, was a long time ago, 50, 60 years. Things have gotten worse since then, with the influence of television and the permissive Dr. Spock philosophy and what's going on in schools and everything else. Dr. Benjamin Spock was a pediatrician whose views on child raising were especially influential in the 1950s and 60s. But going on with Nietzsche, what I see in him is a striving for a higher type of humanity. To me, that means a more beautiful, more noble human being and human existence. You see that throughout Nietzsche, and to me, that is the core of his teaching. "And there was this Tennyson poem I really liked in those years," said Pierce. Tennyson was the poet laureate of England. The poem is called Ulysses. Let me see if I can find it. Pierce stood up, turned around, and briefly scanned his bookcase and extracted a small book. He turned back toward me and, still standing and without any introduction, began reading from the beginning. Quote, "It little profits an idle king," end quote, and read all the way to the end of the 70-line poem. An aged Ulysses declares that he will press on with a heroic, adventurous quest to the end of his life. Quote, "I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees," end quote. Quote, "How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use," end quote. The poem ends with a call to others to join him. Quote, "Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." End quote. When Pierce finished reciting the Tennyson poem, he carefully returned the book to its place on the bookshelf and sat down again, and we looked at each other silently for a time. You've been listening to our continuing audiobook series based on the biography of white nationalist William Pierce. Be with us next time when we'll present another chapter of The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds by Robert S. Griffin.